Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Joe Salvo. For those of you that don't know, I am the current president of the Copyright Society, and I would like to, on behalf of the Copyright Society, welcome you all here today to this wonderful program. Very great to see everybody here, and now without further ado, I'd like to bring up Matt Moore, who's the co-chair of the New York chapter.
On behalf of Craig Mendy, the other co-chair who wasn't able to make it this afternoon, and myself, thank you for coming. It's a great crowd. I think everybody from the waiting list was able to make it in, so that's great. And I'd like to give some special thanks to the volunteers in the planning group for today's event, Kellen Bergstrand and John Knapp, and especially to Cynthia Arado, who is the head of the planning group. Thank you very much for making this event possible. So now to today's panel, which focuses on the right of the people to peaceably aggregate or not. I'm going to pass the mic to Liz McNamara for an introduction of the panel and today's topic, which is content aggregation, fair use or a use too far. So without further ado, I'd like to bring the panel up. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Good afternoon, everyone. We have a great panel. I hope this is going to be fun. I want to introduce, I think, down at the far end first is Bill Herman. He's an assistant professor in film and media studies at Hunter College, CUNY. His primary area of expertise is the law and regulation of new media technologies, including copyright, digital rights management, and internet policy. He's published in journals such as the Yale Journal of Law and Technology, Communication Law and Policy, and he, in 2013, he published a book, The Fight Over Digital Rights, The Politics of Copyright and Technology, out of Cambridge Press, and it's an examination of the debate over copyright technologies in the digital era. Andy Seller, who's in the middle, is the Corydon Dunham First Amendment Fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard and a staff attorney at the Berkman Center's Digital Media Law Project. He studies internet free speech and intellectual property matters and helps run the center's online media legal network, a pro bono referral clinic for online journalism ventures. He received a JD from George Washington University Law School, where he was awarded the Peter D. Rosenberg Award for Patent and Intellectual Property Law. And finally, but not least, is my partner, Linda Steinman, to my left at Davis Wright Tremaine. Linda and I represented the Associated Press in the Meltwater, Associated Press versus Meltwater case that we'll be discussing in part today. And her principal areas of expertise are First Amendment and intellectual property. She spent 8 years as the director of litigation at Random House before returning to private practice, and she represents a broad array of clients on copyright matters, including the Association of American University Presses. I want to begin. We're here today, as you heard. We're going to be talking about aggregation, search engines, and fair use, a topic that people generally have a fair amount of different points of view on, depending upon where you sit at any given moment. I want to begin by just giving a very brief rundown on the relevant case law so that we just have a foundation for my questions and what the panel is going to be discussing. I think it's fair to say that this state of the law in this area is in a state of flux, and the basic assumptions are changing. For some time, some advocates had argued strenuously that what's free on the internet is free for the taking. I think that proposition has been dealt at least a little bit of a blow with the AP versus Meltwater decision. But still, we're left with, does the net societal benefit now outweigh an owner's copyright interest in his or her content? And the foundation, of course, to any analysis that we're going to talk about here is the Supreme Court's acceptance of Judge LaValle's transformative use as the critical basis for any fair use analysis. In Campbell in 94, as we all know, the court asked, does the new work merely supersede the original, or does it add further purpose with a different character, new meaning, or message? And in any aggregation discussion, all loads lead back to Kelly versus Arribasoff and Perfect 10 out of the Ninth Circuit, where the court found that search engines' delivery of photos was a fair use. And the decisions are often overlooked, turned on two critical facts. First, that they were thumbnail images that were of such low resolution that they couldn't act as a substitute for the original work. And second, the court accepted as a given that search engines acted as actual pointers that drove users to original sites and therefore served a valuable societal function of congregating in images from the vast sea of the web. From Kelly and Perfect 10 evolved the concept that a different purpose of the use was sufficient for transformativeness, even if the use didn't alter the original with new expression, meaning, or message. Thus, while the Second Circuit had rejected the different purpose rationale in Infinity Broadcasting in 98, involving a subscription service to get access to radio stations, the Third Circuit embraced a different purpose as being sufficiently transformative in AV versus iParadigms, where plagiarism software was used student papers to discern whether new papers constituted plagiarism. So that brings us to 2012 and 2013, which is going to be the focus of our discussion here, and the HathiTrust case, the Meltwater case, and the Google books. Judge Coates' decision in Associated Press versus Meltwater gave new life, as I indicated, to claims against the use of aggregated content obtained by scraping the web. Meltwater, for those who didn't know, is one of the world's largest media monitoring services. It's a closed subscription-based entity, and once you subscribe, you get delivered once or twice a day, morning and evening, news reports to largely PR people and companies, and the content was obtained from scraping the web. What was delivered were the actual headline of the story, the lead of the article, and a hit sentence which contained your search term. There was no more than 440 characters delivered, and that's characters, not words. And it also included a link to the article. Meltwater argued, based upon Kelly and Perfect 10, that they were a search engine acting as a pointer to the actual content, could not act as a substitute, and therefore their use was a fair use. The court rejected Meltwater's argument and found instead that it was a classic modern-day clipping service, neither transformative nor fair, and that the court looked more closely at the whole concept of click-throughs and clicking, and that it had evolved from the presumptions in Kelly to a more sophisticated analysis about what is the rate. And it was found in Meltwater that the rate was 0.5% of the AP articles, and in the UK there was a click-through rate of about 1% of the Meltwater service. So I think one could say it was rather abysmal. Therefore, the court found, Meltwater wasn't acting as your proverbial pointer. So that leads us finally to the Authors Guild cases, which will no doubt be decided by the Second Circuit in the next year or so. With HathiTrust, it involved a systematic digitization of the entire Michigan and other libraries, and two primary uses were at issue in Judge Baer's decision. One was allowing the full-text searches of books, but the results showed only the page numbers on which the search terms appeared and did not deliver any actual content from the books. It also provided a service that allowed access for people with sight disabilities. Judge Baer had no trouble finding that these were fair uses, that they were used for an entirely different purpose, that they were acting as a pointer to the original works, and that they could be used as a method of academic inquiry, and therefore served a valuable public service for that reason as well as to blind readers. With Authors Guild and Google, it's also challenging the copying of millions of books, But there, the users are allowed to search within the books for terms and deliver brief excerpts with links to buy the book elsewhere. Based on the oral argument before Judge Chin last month, I think it's safe to predict that he will find that this is a fair use with his repeated references to the net societal benefit of the service. So with that very brief outline of kind of the status of the law, I want to really get now into my panelists and questions. And my first question goes to you, Andy, and it's, if you were Meltwater's counsel, what would you believe to be their best argument? And in addition to that, I want to note that recently, I know Dale is here, who's representing Fox News, had filed an action against TVEyes, which is somewhat of a companion case, I would say, to the Meltwater case, and it involves a video news monitoring service. And do you think that the TVEyes case would result in any different decision than the Meltwater case? So both questions to you.
Sure. Let me just quickly say thank you very much for having me here. I came down from Boston this morning, and I'm totally excited to be here. I think it's a very important question for the bar to be addressing as a group. And I'm grateful that we're all doing it. I work with people on both sides of the aggregation debate. I work with a lot of startup journalism ventures, some of which are aggregators, some of which are journalists being aggregated. So I'd say my views are probably a little more nuanced or equivocal than Meltwater's counsel, but let me try my best. And I'll start with sort of what Meltwater, in my opinion, should be or was aiming to be, the sort of platonic ideal of what Meltwater is. And then we'll turn and talk a little bit about Meltwater as it actually played out. So to the transformativeness question, Liz already teed up the two words that had been dominating, or two phrases, I should say, that have been dominating this debate, the first being search engine and the second being news clipping service. There are a line of cases on both sides showing that one is a fair use because it is transformative, one is not a fair use because it is not. News clipping is generally considered not to be transformative because it's doing the same thing that the news was trying to do in the first place, which is inform the public about an issue, whereas search engines were tended to be found, in fact, I think universally were found up until the Meltwater case, to be a transformative use because they were not serving as a substitute for the original. They were used as an information location tool. And so the copying that had to be done in order to build the corpus that they would then search, this is into the technology a little bit. In order for a search engine to work, they can't just simply look it up on the web every time the way you do when you go to Google. They actually have to copy all of the web locally and run searches off of that. Otherwise, a search would take 5 to 10 minutes to complete instead of the fractions of a second that users expect. Found to be a transformative use in the search engine case, not found to be a transformative use in the news clipping case. And if you follow that rhetoric into the briefs of the case and into the decision of the case, you will see exactly that being raised every time. Every time the AP was talking about Meltwater, they referred to them as a news clipping service. Every time Meltwater referred to themselves, they were trying to use the word search engine. I believe at one point they even changed the name of their service,
which happened
to be a media reporting service. They changed to media search engine service. So they're clearly trying to force that rhetoric down, and somewhere along the way, I think we lost a little bit of what we're trying to do here. There's a reason why one of these was found to be transformative and one of these was not. And Judge Coates said it exactly in the opinion in Meltwater, which is the search engine, at least a search engine working the way a transformative search engine would, is not trying to provide you the content. It's trying to sift through the deluge of data and direct a user to the original source. So you have the filtering and surfacing of information that requires you to make a copy in order to have it run at a level that users will expect, and then you have the direction to the source. And I think that obviously we can talk about the factors, so I'm sure we're going to get into the weeds here a little bit, but this sort of complements versus substitutes, that to me seems like the ideal way to handle the news aggregation question. If a site is actually working as an aggregator, it should be sending users to the original content. And if it's not, and if it's a substitute for the original, it's hard to say that it's transformative. It's doing the same thing that the original service was doing, or the original expression was doing. And so I think it's harder to make the transformative use argument. And so let's go to Meltwater. Did it or did it not? So we had we teed up sort of what Meltwater did. It took the first 300 characters of the story, which is the lead, and then another 140 characters around your search term, so the hit sentence. And then there was data thrown by both sides into whether or not this was a substitute or whether or not it was a complement. We already hit on the 0.5, or I think it actually for the opinion here was less than that. It was 0.1 or 0.08% of the links that Meltwater served were actually clicked on to get to the original. Meltwater, on the other hand, raised the number of 6.7 million, which was the total number of hits that they had through their service over, I'm not sure if that was in general or just a fixed period of time. I think both of these numbers don't get to the question. The 6.7 million number was chided by the court in the Meltwater decision as being just a raw number, but neither of these numbers is really answering the critical question. And if you go to email marketing analytics and you go to email marketing data people, you'll find that that 0.1% number is not as crazy as it initially sounds. It sounds so low, it sounds like, my God, that's 0.1%. Of course that has to be a substitute. But when I talk to email marketing people about this, they say, look, there's a couple things to keep in mind. One is that 90% of the emails you send, roughly, it's about, I think, 84% of emails that you send in these blast digests are never opened. So however many links were in there, that email got deleted before it even got opened. Another thing to keep in mind is that the click-through rate that they expect as about average, the mean rate, this is from Silverpop, which is an email marketing service put out there. They measure it not as the number of clicks versus links served. They measure it as the number of clicks versus emails sent. So regardless of how many links were within the given email, they said a good rate, an average rate, a working rate, was about 2 or 3% of emails resulting in a click. Just one click, not necessarily every link. And I think anecdotally we all kind of get this, right? So I know I get a bunch of news digest emails. I get the MLRC email. I get the Business News Associates Copyright Daily email. I get one from the Suffolk Media Law. I get one from Harvard. And I click on one maybe once in a while, depending if I'm like in a down moment at work or not. And when I do open one, I may click on one or two links, but I'm certainly not opening every single link. And so when I talked to a friend of mine, Brian Whaley, who does this at HubSpot, and I mentioned the question of, you know, if I told you that I had an email digest, and the digest came daily or twice daily, and it had a click-through rate per link served of about 0.5%. He told me that, I mean, this is one person, but he told me that, you know, that was about what he'd expect. And that the 0.1% he thought was low, but not necessarily unreasonably low. And the problem I have with the Meltwater decision is specifically the weight that was given to that data. There was no dispute over the data, but the weight we are giving to it, we are assuming too much with that data. There was some argument raised in the briefing that there were reasons why that would be discounted. You know, obviously you may not care about the story that's coming up. Like, yes, you're reading the lead, but maybe you would never have clicked on that in the first place, or maybe you just deleted the email. There are a lot of different reasons why you would not necessarily click through. Also, you can only be expected to click through one or two emails in a given blast. You're not necessarily going to be going down the line clicking all of them. So I drive you up to the critical question, and then I leave you unsatisfied because I say that I think this is the important question, and this is the question that I'm not satisfied by the facts that were put out by the Meltwater decision.
Okay, let me jump in there.
Please.
And I'm being agnostic here, so... Linda, I'll let you, you're not agnostic. Do you have any response to that?
I think my first is number schmumbers. I think that...
Like a true lawyer.
I think that Judge Coate was influenced by many, many things and that the numbers were the least of it. I think that she was greatly influenced by the fact that this Meltwater at its core was a business that was just making money on the backs of other people's content. It was simply taking many, many, you know, it scraped 120,000 news sources, and it was just taking their content and reselling it. And she saw that as exploiting, you know, other people's work. She recognized broadly how expensive and difficult it is to create journalism, that an enormous amount of work and time goes into it. And she looked carefully at how Meltwater had marketed its service. And they called their daily emails, news reports, and all their PR materials made clear that these were news digests or this is a way to get your news easily or, you know, read this if you don't have a lot of time and it'll tell you everything you need to know. So she was very aware of that. She was very aware of the fact, obviously, there's no commentary. There were some minor analytics that were really quite silly. Our favorite was this cloud. If you put in the word, say, Obama, there would be a cloud that showed how often that word was used, and Obama would be in really big letters because Obama was used a lot. This is the nature of the analytics. So she was clear-minded in sort of what the nature of this business was. And it is true that, you know, they tried to recast themselves as a search engine, but she recognized that that was a litigation-inspired position and that what it really was at its core was a business trying to make money off of the backs of other businesses. I think she also was aware of the differences between Meltwater and some other search engines, the fact that they were delivering the lead in contrast, for example, to Google Alerts, the fact that we were able to show that many of the AP stories were very short, so, you know, a good half of the article would be picked up on Meltwater. And although she doesn't talk about it, I think she also understood the changes today that people often are perfectly satisfied with a headline and a lead of an article that tells them what they need to know, and that these types of services really could take away important audiences for AP. So I think, sure, she mentioned the numbers, and we were able to show Meltwater made a very bad mistake, which was, you know, they came in, they said, we are a search engine. And she said, okay. We said to them, okay, show us you're a search engine. You're really acting as a pointer. What is your click-through rate? And all we heard was, oh, we couldn't figure that out. Our systems would crash. You know, we can't tell you what our click-through rate is. And we said, oh, come on. If you claim that this is, you know, your transformative use, you got to prove it. And they said, no, 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 it's not relevant. It's not relevant. It's not relevant. And we said, are you sure? And they said, oh, it's not relevant. And so when we got to court, we were able to put in very effective affidavits showing that they refused to give us this data. And she didn't like that. And I think that helped us a lot.
Let me turn and bring you, Bill, into the discussion. And as I mentioned in my intro, Judge Chin seemed to be very influenced by the notion in the Google Books case that Google was providing this great benefit to society, which, of course, I think is something that Google generally advocates. And I want to ask you whether that really is, whether you think that's a reasonable inquiry or basis to override copyright interests, that the user is providing a benefit to society.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to note at the outset, I think we could all agree that benefit to society is certainly not dispositive. Otherwise, Campbell v. Cuff Rose would have gone the other way. Right. I certainly don't think Two Life Crew,
it was a positive
contribution to society.
I disagree.
And also, I think Robin Thicke then would have to start watching his back as well. Don't value his contributions particularly as well either. But in all seriousness, I think contribution to society is, I think it's valuable to the extent that that's acceptable as a layman's way of explaining transformativeness as contributing something to the broader information ecosystem. Now, whether that's good for society is certainly something I don't think we want involved in the jurisprudence. I think that's those sort of moral or ethical questions like that, independent of the ethics of specific lawyers acting in specific cases saying, oh, this is really important, and how can you dare expect us to back up this claim or whatever other, you know, the broader ethics of the whether somebody's good for society, I think, is a different question than are they doing something that's new, that's different, that's unique. And I think that that's as a way to help explain that to people who aren't trained in copyright law, you know, explaining transformativeness by way of saying I'm making some sort of new contribution or some sort of additional value, I think is reasonably acceptable, and I think that, but I think that should be viewed more as a PR talking point than as a sort of dispositive or even carrying substantial weight in the case, and I think we should look back at the more at the factors per se.
Well, a different way that argument gets spun is the argument that really was put forth in the Meltwater case. It's been put forth in HathiTrust and Perfect 10 and Kelly, this whole line of cases, which is really that it's a functional use. They're not arguing in any of these cases that they're really engaging in transformativeness in the sense of the Campbell case, where you're adding commentary and new message and new aesthetic content. It's a functionality. So I really ask all the panels, whoever wants to jump in here, should these cases be treated differently, and is there a legitimate role for pure functionality as a form of transformativeness?
If as the person who's spoken the least so far, if I may start off here.
Absolutely.
I think it's absolutely essential to look at this case in the context of the explosion of information that has happened since the mass adoption of the internet. I mean, we've gone from the point where the Library of Congress used to represent the epitome of the sum of knowledge that's available to all of humankind, and the Library of Congress now is more like a rounding error if we're to add up the total knowledge that's available to all of mankind. Now, admittedly, a very large chunk of that knowledge is tweets and Facebook posts, which aren't particularly knowledge, as we would say, but still, the point is that there's an insanely, immeasurably, inconceivably large amount of information out there right now, and the ability to navigate that information, to maneuver through that information, is going to be increasingly difficult, going to require increasingly sophisticated tools, and those tools are going to require increasingly sophisticated abilities to dip into a wide array of information sources and make sense of those on behalf of users. And I'd also say I think and obviously this is dicta rather than part of the decision, but I think that I'm pretty upset by Judge Coates' language about this not counting as a legitimate search engine or a real search engine, because the only difference between this and Google News, we could also talk about word count, which I think is also an important one in terms of amount, but other than that, the only difference between the part of this that leads to a finding for the plaintiff and a Google News subscription service, where I just did, just yesterday, just as a test case, created another news alert for Google to have start having, I stopped reading them as Andy points out, so I unsubscribed to them years ago, but just as an exercise for today, just resubscribe to this. And it's exactly what they're talking about, again, except for a slightly different word count. And so the fact that the search engine is a private service rather than a public service, I don't think copyright should really take that into account. I think that there's no basis in the statute or in the case law for saying, oh, you charge money for your service rather than serving ads for your service, and it's only available privately to subscribers rather than available publicly. I don't really view that as an especially important distinction. I mean, maybe with some marginal impact on the commerciality effect, a commerciality measure. But other than that, I mean, I certainly the way that Judge Coates is just willing to set this aside is like, oh well, that means you're not a search engine. I'm really upset by that, because increasingly, the more information we have, the more trouble we're going to have managing it, and the ability to hire private people to do that for us as a private service is going to be especially important as people look for ways to gain advantage over their competitors rather than merely having to rely on the tools that are publicly available.
But Bill, I mean, you would agree, don't you, that Google does emphasize and distinguish and puts a lot of credence on the notion that it's a public service available open to all comers. But that what they don't emphasize as much is just how much they're monetizing all of us being there, and that they do actually are, as we know, a multi-billion-dollar company that has been created on the users. So can you just speak for a moment, and then I'll turn to Andy and Linda on some of the thoughts you've raised on kind of the monetization and whether there is a real commercial distinction between a private subscriber entity like Meltwater and a Google.
I mean, I think I've already kind of said what I had to say about that, which is that Google is an incredibly profitable company. At one point, I think I've heard rumors that the SEC was threatening to declare them a bank. They were sitting on so much cash, right? So clearly, they're an incredibly profitable company, and the ability to manage other people's copyrighted works and help people sort through that and decide what they want to click through is an important part of that. And by the way, the building block of, and I do want to go back to click-through rates because I think this is illustrative. Not only in email newsletters, but if you look at click-through rates on ads, which are placements on websites that people pay for, that people want, that people willingly pay money, and enough money that Google is sitting on 9-10 figures worth of cash, right? The click-through rates on a typical Google banner ad at the top and the side of a search bar, about 0.09%. Right? So people are paying for the kind of click-through rates that that the AP sued over in Clickwater. So I think that should tell us something. I think that should tell us something, that getting even a little bit of increasing awareness there is important. And I also want to point out that the commercial nature of the enterprise on the input side, I also think is much overemphasized by Judge Coate, right? It really strikes me, it comes across like the lower court rulings in the Rural v. Feist case, right? Where it's like, oh, look at all the sweat on these people's brows, right? There are a lot of sweaty brows in the opening of the AP Meltwater case, right? Look how hard it is to put together. Yeah, it's hard, but it's primarily factual information, right? So the fact that it takes a lot of information, a lot of effort and a lot of energy and a lot of investment to put together a primarily fact-based information service that is the news, right? I don't think the effort, the investment that those commercial operators put in should be at nearly as emphasized as it is in the Meltwater case.
So, Linda, you want to respond to that?
Absolutely. Let me start sort of from the beginning. There was much to cover. I actually am the proponent of a theory that no judge has yet picked up, but maybe one day they will. I think that there should be a slightly different type of analysis for a transformative use argument that's based on an expressive use, whether that's a painting, appropriation art, a book, and these functional transformative arguments that, you know, where the search engines or anybody else says, I'm serving a different function, I'm letting somebody get there faster. Or the iParadigms case, it's a different function, it's plagiarism detection software. I think that the core, the very heart of the fair use doctrine is based on the desire to, you know, spur new creative uses. And in that heart, there should sort of be one type of analysis, and that there should be a slightly different test when you're looking at a functional, a transformative use argument that's based on a different function. And in those cases, the court should be looking much more carefully at two things. One is this a superseding use? Is the use capable of substituting for the original, which is actually language that came from the Kelly decision. I think the Kelly decision is actually a pretty good decision as opposed to the Perfect 10 decision. And Kelly said, these tiny thumbnail photos are not capable of substituting for the original. They're lousy, blurry photos, and they couldn't do what those gorgeous photos of naked women could do. And I think that the key language is, you know, these excerpts that Meltwater used, they were capable of substituting for the original. They often gave you enough of what you needed, and therefore that shouldn't be a fair use, as opposed to something like the HathiTrust Index, which telling you the page number of a book is not capable of substituting for the book.
But there is a tension there, yes? I mean, I think that especially for people who are representing media clients, and of course, because there is the line of the digital use cases, the search engine type cases, there's another line of cases where we see fair use raised when the entire work is being taken, and that's in the media cases. That's in photographs specifically. I come from the First Circuit, I'm from Boston, and we have in the First Circuit the Nunez case concerning photographs that were originally taken for modeling that were then later used in a newspaper. Supposedly because it was like this woman was later named Miss Puerto Rico, and so this was a very scandalous photo, and the newspaper kind of put up there saying, wow, look at this scandalous photo. Don't you think maybe this person shouldn't be Miss Puerto Rico? Which is, you know, very pretextual. But one on a fair use case saying that, look, the original use was aesthetic, this use is informative.
Yes, and I think that was correctly decided, and I put that in the expressive category. Newspapers are in my expressive category.
But there's also, so the other thing in every case discussing fair use, in that initial paragraph that the clerk writes where we're talking about what fair use is and the factors are not dispositive, the very last thing we always quote is that these are all taken together and considered in light of the purposes of copyright. And the purpose of copyright, if you accept Judge LaValle's paper on the question, is this sort of productive, generating more works. And there's an argument to be made for all of these, if functioning as complements instead of substitutes, that they are actually helping us because, as Judge LaValle noted in his paper, all works are based on pre-existing works, and you need to find the pre-existing works to build upon them. So even a use that is purely repurposing the original work, if it's not meant to be a replacement, would be, I think, transformative in that way. And also, wouldn't the fourth factor largely shake out the superseding question as well? Wouldn't it also go to the fourth factor analysis?
It certainly would, but I think that you have to look harder at the superseding question when you have a functional use as opposed to an expressive use. I think, again, you look at the Nunez case as a perfect example, or the art appropriation cases, you know, looking at something, writing about a photo or a piece of artwork that uses a piece of, a photograph in a different manner. Those are likely not to supersede. There's not such a threat.
Can I have you come explain this to every academic publisher ever, by the way? Because they all insist on ridiculous clearances for photos and media artifacts. And I'm on the first part of this, you and I are totally on the same page. Anyway, sorry, continue.
Open access is next week. We'll go from there.
Let me interject on one point here, which is also, I think, something else that's playing out in this disconnect that we're hearing is the one-off situation of a Nunez and using a photograph one time versus having a systematic use of massive amounts of data and data mining it. And I agree, and I ask the panelists to opine on this to some degree, is that we have seen, I think, an evolution of experience and thought in this area. Because when you went back and looked at the Kelly case originally, it was presumed that this stuff could not act as a substitute. I think that we've all now lived with aggregation for a long period of time. We've all adjusted our approach to it. Substitution, I think, has come to mean something a little different now than it did 10 years ago. And I asked the panelists for thoughts on that. I mean, I think Linda touched on that. That when you nowadays, I think we're all comfortable with essentially getting our news with a headline and, you know, a squib, and that really can act as sufficient, so that if an aggregator is commercially exploiting headline and a squib, is that aggregator not acting as a substitute?
Substitute as to what, I guess, would be my question there, because in some ways now, and this is something that was coming out throughout the Meltwater decision, is we were substituting news with expression a lot in that opinion. And copyright is only supposed to care about one of them. And indeed, we were repeatedly reminded through INS, through Feist, through a lot of the major cases that copyright's relationship to the news is as to the expression and not to the underlying facts. And when you take some of the headlines, so a headline in the Associated Press this morning, I'll say this twice because I think it's really important, the Red Sox beat the Cardinals 8-1 in the World Series opener. I'll say it again. The Red Sox beat the Cardinals 8-1 in the World Series opener. It's hard to say that another way and have that same information come across. And some of the articles in the Meltwater decision, not all, but some of them were of that ilk. Senator Ted Stevens dies in a plane crash. Toledo is looking for bids for something, I forget
as
now.
As I recall, that had a phenomenal lead, though, the Ted Stevens. That was highly creative, and it may have been selected.
This is why
it
was dangerous going up against the person who actually litigated it. But the the headline in the lead.
Can I read it to you?
Please, lay it on me.
To much of the nation, Ted Stevens was the crotchety senator who famously referred to the Internet as a series of tubes and fought to build the bridge to nowhere. That's what they took.
I love that.
Can I just point out that I was the intern at Public Knowledge who made the recording of the Ted Stevens speech, and I get like zero credit for this. Nobody knows this because Wired. I
sure you have a copyright in the sound recording.
It's a government work, right? But the come on, man. You just copyright, right? I at least wanted Public Knowledge to get credit, and Wired, a blog at Wired, hot linked us, and framed that as something that they just had. And unless you looked at the URL, you didn't even know that that was from Public Knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I, even if that had been a copyrighted work that we had produced, I still don't think even we would have tried to exercise a copyright in that because I don't like that's how we feel about the circulation of information. Although obviously, as an issue advocacy group, they have every interest in that information just getting out. And if their hands aren't dirty on that particular ageist meme that came out, so much the better.
Well, let me ask, because I think you really are getting to the nub of this. You're focusing, I think everyone's focusing on this disconnect between is there any proprietary interest in pure news and is there not proprietary interest in news. And I think that as we've demonstrated, there is a lot of, and I think as Judge Cote found in her decision, there's a lot of creative element that goes into creating headlines, goes into creating leads, goes into creating content from the articles. And if I'm hearing you correctly, you're not advocating that the people who create that, invest in that, make that happen, have no copyrightable interest in that, are you?
No, but I think at a certain point, part of the inverted pyramid, which was the great discussion here, not so much in the Ted Stevens example, which you beautifully laid in front of me, but in a lot of the other articles, is a lot of times what you're trying to engineer there is you're trying to get to the raw facts. And we know now from Eldred and Golan, the two Supreme Court cases on the intersection of copyright and fair use, I'm sorry, copyright and the First Amendment, that the idea expression dichotomy is now appears to be one of only two planks that are the definitional balancing between copyright and free expression. To me, that means that the idea expression dichotomy cannot be empty. It cannot be something where we are actually thinking carefully about repeating something that we heard because we're afraid about expressing it in the same way that we heard it. In general, for long form pieces, for even pieces that employ the turn of phrase there, I think that this is less of a concern. But when we're trying to get a sense of the news by looking at these things, I'm seriously questioning whether or not we're actually substituting the need for the original expression rather than taking advantage of the fact that the expression is conveying some news.
I absolutely think that's right. I mean, the substitution here is now I don't have to go read that article because I've learned the facts inside that are contained in the headline and the lead. And to the extent that that's the substitution test, I think that militates a fair use at that point. I actually have an illustrative example. I went and tried to find a couple other articles that weren't AP articles, which in our decimated newsrooms today is increasingly hard to do. But I tried to find AP news articles about the same subjects. And
there might be a reason for those decimated newsrooms.
It's true, but that
was a softball.
But the marginal gain in potential licensing revenue that somebody like Meltwater could pitch in is not the difference. It really isn't the difference. It's the fact that people go on the internet freely to get this information, and that only a few newspapers have been successfully able to monetize that by turning it into a paywall. But I'm encouraged by the fact that it's not only the Wall Street Journal but also the New York Times has been able to do so. I think your major broadsheets in each major city, at least like the Denver Post, which just instituted a paywall, is having some success with it, and so on. I could talk about this all day, actually. But I think that's a business model issue, not a copyright issue. The amount of money available here is not going to save the newsroom, right? But just to give you this example, here's the headline from the first article in the appendix, right? Title: Headline: Help Wanted for New Casino in Toledo, Ohio. The excerpt in its entirety: Job seekers can roll the dice to land work at another of the four casinos coming soon to Ohio. Hollywood Casino Toledo has posted more than 600 job openings on its website this week, and then it lists the job types that are available, right? Here's the Blade in Toledo, Ohio. Toledo Casino posts 600 job openings. The Hollywood Casino Toledo posted more than 600 job openings on its website. People interested in applying for jobs should go to the website. The casino's announcement did not mention whether the jobs are full-time or part-time. Now, here's the only expressive thing I can find in the AP version that gets quoted. The opening phrase, right, job seekers can roll the dice to land work at another, right, of the casinos, right? So in other words, we're quibbling about whether a hackneyed topical metaphor, right, is sufficient expression versus the facts that are conveyed to in order to give AP the right to stop people from helping people find that specific news article, whether this is too much of that pretty much factual information and then one hackneyed metaphor. And I think really, other than the hackneyed metaphor, there's no expression here. It's just a set of facts. And the order of the facts, there's only so many ways that you can do it. I mean, you could say the Red Sox smacked the Cardinals, they destroyed
sure.
the Cardinals,
absolutely.
They obliterated the
definitely.
Cardinals. Right? But the sports writers struggle with this all the time. There's only so many ways to do that, which is why sites like Deadspin and Grantland are so wildly popular, because they do other things than simply regurgitate the facts. They find new ways that are truly expressive. And newspapers need to figure out a better way to do those sorts of things. And to the extent that that's the type of article that would be included here, you're not going to get that out of the headline and the lead. You're going to have to read the whole article. And at that point, it's not the more expressive it is, the less this is a substitute.
Well, I think that, and I'll let Linda address this, because I think one
lucky
thing...
Lucky Linda.
Because I think one of the factors that obviously influenced, I think, Judge Coates' decision in Meltwater, and that is obviously a legitimate inquiry under the fair use analysis, is market harm and showing that whether you do have a market in this, and whether the use by a Google or a Meltwater or whatever is informing... or hurting that market. So do you want to speak to that?
Thank you for setting me up, Liz. We were able to show that AP is actually different than many other news organizations, and AP actually has a very extensive licensing business. They have brought in substantial revenues from other news aggregators, and we were able to also show at the time they had an agreement with a license with Google. So AP does bring in genuine revenue through this model. Let me also address, I think that, I appreciate that one particular article wasn't AP's finest, but I think that there is a tremendous art in distilling facts. What AP does and what makes AP so great is that they are able, in a very concise fashion, really to capture the news, to write it in a way so that when you read the lead, you know what happened. And journalism is an art. I have a tremendous respect for journalists. And I think that, sure, their job is to convey facts, but the beauty is how they do it. And if you have a service like a Meltwater, it's appropriating for itself all that effort that the and craft creativity that the AP editors and writers put into their stories. Let me also just pick up on a little of the back and forth here. I do think that we've been skirting around but haven't really addressed the core public policy issue here, which is that newspapers really are struggling and many of them dying. And I think it's far too glib to say, oh, it's the problem, that's for other reasons, or, oh, they have a problem with their business model. The fact is that many people today are getting their news through a different vehicle than the newspaper website, and therefore the newspapers are not getting the ad dollars that allows them, that is their business model. And I think it's a very bad thing for our society. As a democracy, we desperately need good newspapers, investigative journalists who have the time and resources to really dig deep, to find that corruption at the state level, to find those documents that the government is not revealing to us. We need that type of journalism. And I'm very worried that the aggregators are leading to the demise of a critical institution in our country.
Well, from the lofty,
sure.
Can we have something
yeah,
we can go down here?
Yeah, so I completely agree that I worry a lot. I mean, obviously, I'm here as a copyright scholar. I am a First Amendment scholar by my title. And I worry a lot about the journalism and journalism as a practice. I think there are the same internet, which is bringing us all this concern and this consternation today, has also brought tremendous developments in the act of reporting. We've seen the development of a networked Fourth Estate, to borrow a term that Yochai Benkler, who's one of the faculty directors at my center, has coined, where people are sharing information and relying on each other and drawing on experts in a way that allow us to see more news catered to our particular interests, to facilitate things like public records requests. There have been some amazing technologies being developed by Code for America, by Google, by others to get into the government and get public records out. I think the same technologies that are bringing us concern today are doing tremendous things for journalism. And I think there's still a place where they can compete with the aggregators or indeed license with the aggregators. So we mentioned that AFP, the French AP, and Google got into this major fight, and it looked like it was going to be this big fight over copyright and headlines, and then it settled, and we know that Google got a license. I don't think Google backed down on their arguments here. I have no inside knowledge here. I think instead they realized that it is far too easy to start an aggregator, and we need to compete on something else. I would not be surprised if they got more than just the right to license the blurbs there when they settled. I think they might have gotten something along the lines of early access. So obviously news is coming to us faster and faster. Our demand for news is faster and faster. If I was able to get the AP Wire story before the AP Wire story got out to other services, and I was then able to email my clients as it was hitting newspapers, my gosh, I'd pay a lot of money for that service. Yeah. Same idea, but leveraging the fact that the AP is generating the stories, that means they have it first. And sure, after a minute or two, the story is going to be running wild all over the place. But certainly in that first moment, which is where people want news these days, there's a tremendous opportunity. I think it's now too antiquated to think of technology companies and media companies as being two separate entities. We're seeing a lot of technology innovation happening in the media ecosystem. I do want to highlight Dan Sinker, who runs the Knight Mozilla Foundation technology in media program. I forget exactly what they call it. The Knight Mozilla Fellows basically get embedded in journalism areas, so they get embedded at the Boston Globe. But for me, I think there's one going to the New York Times this year. And they're coders, and their whole job is just develop tools for the newsroom and develop tools for the newsroom to do things better. So I think that we should be thinking about these things for sure, but we should keep in mind that copyright is not the dominant player in this space, that news's relationship with copyright is a bit more thin than we sometimes tend to think as copyright lawyers.
Bill, I'll let you have the last word, and then I want to open it up to questions for the group in the last few minutes that we have.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with everything Andy said, and I'm not being glib. I think it's
I'm sorry.
Seriously, this has not only a professional relevance to me, but a personal and emotional one. I grew up reading the Rocky Mountain News, the late great Rocky Mountain News, and I don't take that. The death of that newspaper lately. I don't take the death of any newspaper lately. And I think moving from duopolies to monopolies of serious newspapers in major cities, which by the way was a process that had started long before the internet, is a serious policy problem that we should address. I think the answer to that is not trying to cling to old business models. The answer to that is not inserting a copyright toll in the internet to try and make sure that any use of these news articles is monetized. I think we have to. I stand by my position that we have to take the factual nature of these articles in general very seriously. The more factual the article, the easier it is to substitute. I will grant that, but that means that the less seriously we have to take the article as a copyrighted work. And the more clearly, thickly protected a copyrighted work it is, the less we have to worry about substitution via copyright. I mean, like if one of these news alerts gives me a Paul Krugman article, the headline and lead of an op-ed like that. I at least know what the article is about, and that's about it. I mean, I know Krugman well enough. I'm going to probably know what his argument looks like, but that's that's because I'm a subscriber to the New York Times, by the way. And I read their stuff. The more expressive and the more creative, the more seriously you are going to have to read that article. I think that's a sufficient answer for the substitute. I also though would like to talk about the licensing issue. Yes, AP has an extensive licensing business, but that's, I mean, so this brings us into the sort of the how many angels on the head of a pin, like black hole, mental black hole of how do we determine who owes whom licensing revenues? Because we can't say you owe me money because if you don't pay me money, I'm not getting your money. Right? That's that tautological reasoning of other people are willing to buy it, therefore you have to buy it, is not, I'm not particularly persuaded by that. I think to the extent that AP adds special value to it, that AP's services, surely what AP is giving people is better than Google News Alerts, and we've already established that Google, that, you know, the court grants that Google News Alerts are fair use, right? So what else is AP granting to people with these licensing services? Surely there's some value being added there, and to the extent that they can add value to their works by letting people license whole articles, or as Andy pointed out, giving them early release or other sorts of aggregation features that aren't merely the headline and the lead, more power to them. I mean, I'd like to see AP rolling in cash rather than struggling for money, but I don't think sort of suing their competition out of business when their competition is engaging in something that to me looks a lot like a fair. I just don't think, oh, but you're cutting into our licensing revenue is particularly persuasive when they've just through. You know, especially to the extent that, you know, I don't know if this is Google's legal reasoning, but if other people are saying, well, it'll be cheaper to license through the AP than to go and litigate it, that's, you know, the business model of litigation is destroying the world of patentable technologies, and I don't think we should let copyright move down that road either.
Okay, well, it's based on this, I think we can maybe assume, or it might turn out, that Meltwater was a brief moment of a brief Valentine to the news industry that we will all, you know, look at fondly.
You guys should give yourself some credit.
Industry.
That was some excellent briefing and arguing.
But I want to open this up to questions from the group. And before I do so, I just want to remind everybody that your CLE materials were provided via email, and so you should access them if you're interested.
What role does the hot news doctrine play in all of this?
Well, I was going to mention the hot news doctrine because we were getting very close to it about the value, but I'll let Linda do it.
We filed a hot news claim. Judge Coate was rather deft in her management of the case. She said, you know, I was overturned in my last hot news decision, so let's focus on the copyright claim. And she had us do expedited, not so expedited, discovery on the copyright claim, and she decided that. And then after we'd won on the copyright claim, she turned to us and said, do I really have to decide the hot news claim? And we said, no, Your Honor. I think that the hot news claim we always thought was the harder claim for us because the Second Circuit has interpreted it now so narrowly and has more or less suggested that it only applies if there's no attribution. And obviously Meltwater was attributing the stories to the various newspapers. I personally think that that decision is too narrow, that there should be a narrow hot news claim, but that it should still survive even if there's attribution, if some of the other elements are met. There's going to be a decision in the TVI's case. There was a motion to dismiss the hot news claim, so I imagine there'll be a decision on the hot news component in that case. I think the hot news is a delicate. It's hard to balance hot news and the First Amendment, so that's a tough one.
I agree.
Forgive
me, but the judge denied the motion to dismiss the hot news claim in
the TVI's case, saying it's too early, let's have discovery.
Okay, so it's alive. Are there other questions?
Or is it? But you could speak a little bit more about the market harm, because we're seeing more and more circuit court cases, including Second Circuit and others, saying the fourth factor in many cases is the most critical factor. And addressing your point, I think it's one thing if you're the New York Times or Wall Street Journal, where you have a huge coterie of reporters and journalists that are out there, but if you're a regional paper, you're relying on the services to get your news to your community. And to me, there is a real argument, at least there's a strong argument, that there's a public service, you're performing something, and could you flush out what the arguments and evidence were, at least to this point, that were presented on that issue, on that fourth factor?
Sure.
I was going to repeat the question because maybe people in the back didn't hear it. Basically, the question is to focus a little more on the evidence that existed in the Meltwater case on market harm, and particularly with small newspapers being able to, you know, monetize and be able to get remuneration for what they're publishing and how that came out in the Meltwater case.
I think fortunately there are a fair number of decisions now, including some Supreme Court decisions, which have said the fourth factor is not so important. Really, transformative use is the critical question. In our case, we had two theories of market harm. One was that AP had many licenses to other media monitoring services, and therefore this was a traditional market for them, and so Meltwater was not paying the customary price. Many newspapers are not going to be in that situation. We had a second argument, which was there were a couple of instances in which AP seems to have lost clients, particularly government contractor clients, to Meltwater. They both made a pitch to the United States House of Representatives. Neither got it, but both made a pitch. There were a few instances where it appeared that somebody had been getting the AP service and dropped it to get Meltwater. So those were our two theories. The judge was more impressed by the first one. But I think that market harm is often difficult to show, and I do think it's correct that the court should place more emphasis on the transformative use question rather than the market harm question. It's often, just from an evidentiary perspective, difficult to prove, even if in your heart of hearts you think it's really there.
As an academic, it is my obligation to recommend a law review article to you, so I'll do so. Neil Nantinel, about 2 years ago, did a really nice study called Making Sense of Fair Use, where he both reviewed earlier studies by Matthew Sagan, Barton Beebe, and Pam Samuelson, empirically looking at how courts handle the fair use test, as well as doing his own research, because most of those studies stopped by about 2007, and so he did the intervening 5 years. And he found that that's exactly what's been happening, that not only has the court through Campbell instructed us, the Supreme Court, to consider the first factor at least on par with the fourth factor, that courts are indeed putting a lot more weight into the transformativeness test than the market harm test. And if they find a transformative use, as I think the Bill Graham case in the Second Circuit goes, they're pretty comfortable just kind of letting that run a lot of the rest of the analysis, examining everything leaning back into the fact that what they found was transformative. But yeah, Neil Nantinel, who's a professor at UCLA, did an article called Making Sense of Fair Use, which is really does a nice job grappling with a lot of the sort of the weight and difference in the different factors.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question for Bill. So I think, first of all, I think your discussion about whether or not there's creative work in the leads really goes to a different defense, which is copyrightability, not fair use. I don't think, I think maybe they're related in theme, but they're not technically related as defenses. But then you say, okay, so let me now look at creative works, right? So you feel you're covered on news works, right? And then you say, let me look at creative works and say, I'm covered there too if we take a little bit because it's not substitutive, right? So either way, heads you in, tails you in. So my question for you is, can you describe for us a service that you actually think would go too far and would not be fair use?
Yeah, well, I mean, I alluded that when we're talking about Meltwater, if I were on their team, I would have put a lot of emphasis on the number of words here and how that exceeds the Google News search. And I think that's probably the strongest argument, that it starts to look more like a whole article. And so if we just extend that out the point where it's, you know, consistently 50-60% of an article, certainly that would not be fair use. You know, they have a couple examples where it's 60% of like a 100-word article or something. That's, at that point, obviously, that's the headline and the lead really is the article, and there's not a lot of there. But I respectfully disagree. I mean, I know I'm not a JD, but I do read a lot of them, and every copyright textbook I've read and every authority I've read on the second factor says that the second factor is composed of two essential components, and that's, is it published, and how thick is the copyright protection, how creative or classically protectable of a work is it? And the more factual, the less protection there is available. Now, we don't have to go all the way to an alphabetized white pages of something that's utterly non-copyrightable to get to something that's not very thickly protected. For instance, I constantly use the example in my class about case law books. And I always tell my students I would be 100% comfortable taking a selection of cases out of a case law book, edits and all, and posting them on my website as long as I redacted all of the creative expression that's around them. And that's even though nominally there is some creative expression in the editing and selection and the stripping out of all the footnotes and all the other legal garbage-y-gook. Like, that's work, and some of it is creative. Like, where do you make the edit points, right? There's some nominal creativity there, but it's so thin that the fact that it's a government work vastly outweighs anything that I could do with it as long as I'm, you know, unless I'm doing something incredible, like taking every single case out of a case book, edits and all, in exactly the same order, table of contents and all, and then trying to sell my own casebook based on those decisions. Like, that's the point to which I'd have to go in that case, because those works, it's based on works that aren't copyrightable, and the creative decisions are nominal enough that I have to go very, very far for it to not be a fair use. Right, and that's the same. And I think this obviously is a couple steps still closer to a novel, but it's a couple steps on a 1,000-step scale. It's still primarily factual works, and so only to the extent that we have unauthorized copying of expression rather than unauthorized copying of facts, are we really concerned about there being an infringement case here? And I think the facts are really what's important here. I think that's, you're right, I'm picking on the Toledo Casinos article. It's an easy target. But I think that in some sense is illustrative to the extent that there's, if it's just a headline and lead that identifies some facts, that's there, the expressive way of summarizing the facts in 100 words is limited. I'm not going to say it's zero, but it's very limited. And that should weigh.
Well, with that, I want to thank everybody for coming, and I hope you enjoyed the panel. Thank you.
That was great. That was wonderful. Thank you very much.
Can you do it?